Very good morning to everyone. The first case this morning is Rasmussen against Dish. Mr. Kepler.
Honorable Court, Mr. Giesen. This court denied, the bankruptcy court in this case denied Dish relief under his four causes of action under Section 523 of the Bankruptcy Code. Rasmussen successfully defended herself against those four causes of action brought under Section 523 of the Bankruptcy Code. Her discharge was granted on August 19, 2002, a date much in advance of the date of the trial. She was granted a discharge because she complied with the requirements of Section 727 of the Bankruptcy Code and because nobody brought a complaint objecting to discharge under Section 727.
Mechanically, how is that done? This was a ministerial act, was it? Why?
I don't think it's ministerial, Your Honor. Obviously, the court has to review the record. The court has to find out whether or not anybody objected. The court also has to find out whether or not anybody filed a motion to extend the time to object to discharge. None of that was done. So there was a ministerial aspect to it, but it's also based upon the failure of any party to come forward and challenge discharge. So
there was nothing in the file to alert the court that this could be a 727 matter at that point.
Exactly. There's nothing in the file, and no party has come forward to take the action necessary to stop the action where the discharge would be granted.
But in a sense, of course, it's a discharge, but from another practical point of view, it's not the final word, since, as you pointed out, the 523 proceeding had yet to occur.
Your Honor, I do not believe that is correct, because every debt under 523 would still be open, but all the rest of the debts...
Well, that's what I mean. So it's not a complete resolution of what's going to happen to the dispute, because at a minimum, the 523 issues still remained to be determined.
No doubt about it.
Okay. And I take it your principal point here really has to do with the 105 issue, but I wondered on the 90-24 point why everybody was assuming that it was subpart A of the analogy, if you will, to Rule 60 of the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure that was the pertinent one and not B, because 90-24 doesn't say Rule 60A applies in cases under the code. It says Rule 60 applies in cases under the code.
But it also requires a complaint to be filed, Your Honor. If you look at 90-24, it says a complaint to revoke a discharge may be filed only within the time.
Right, within the time. And this complaint was certainly filed well within the time.
There's no complaint asking for revocation. Revocation is a separate complaint as envisioned by the Bankruptcy Code and the Bankruptcy Rules. It's a separate cause of action under Section 727D of the Bankruptcy Code. We're dealing about two completely different formulations of rules dealing with two different issues. Discharge and revocation are separate and complete different issues.
Well, I understand that, but what happened is that the court, in a sense, invites this revocation proceeding. I realize it didn't begin, but there can be no doubt at this point that Mr. Dish is trying to invoke 727 rights.
As of when? I do not agree with
certainly
that.
Certainly right now.
Right now, obviously, there's no doubt that 727 is before this court now.
Yeah.
But I don't think it was ever envisioned that there was a 727 action filed either at the time of the filing of the initial complaint under 523 or that ever a revocation issue was asked or revocation issue was before the court. It was never asked for.
I mean, I think the problem with this case is the concept that there's a gross abuse of the bankruptcy process that's going on here if one does not allow consideration of the 727 point.
Well, then the question is, are we going to be following the rules and the laws and found in the bankruptcy court and code, or are we going to be doing something that takes people by surprise, that does not give litigants the rights that they are envisioned, that are envisioned to be given to them under the bankruptcy code? The bankruptcy code there's a separate cause of action for revocation. So that was not filed. The court wanted to get to an equitable result in this case and found a way to get there. But it did not follow the rules. Greenig, I think, in this case, this court has decided Greenig, and I think you can match the language found in Greenig almost absolutely to a T to find that this case should not allow revocation of the discharge given to Ms. Rasmussen.
Well, here, I mean, there's a Ninth Circuit case that I thought was interesting, In Re Cisneros. It's a 93 case where the court says the order of discharge was entered by the bankruptcy court under a misapprehension as to the facts of the case. Had the court been apprised of the actual facts, it would never have entered the order. In our view, this is precisely the sort of mistake or inadvertence that Rule 60B was intended to reach, et cetera. That sounds a lot like the problem here.
Unfortunately, I'm not familiar with the case, but I do not believe that still when we've got rules out there stating what the grounds for revocation are, if those grounds are not met, how can the court use the bankruptcy code to take away a discharge rightfully granted? The whole code envisions that creditors will exercise their due diligence to find a methodology to object to discharge if they feel that is to be done. If you're going to allow Section 523 to always encompass a Section 727 complaint, litigants are always going to have, or litigants who are the creditors are always going to have an extra arrow in their quiver, which can be used against debtors in a bankruptcy case. You, to the extent that every case in the future under 523 will now have a Section 727 component to it.
I don't think everyone's saying every. There are huge numbers of 523 cases that have no 727 component at all. But the question is, when it becomes clear to the bankruptcy court that there is a 727 component, is there any way the bankruptcy court can undo a discharge that was granted under a mistaken apprehension of the facts?
Well, I don't think the facts, Your Honor, you're allowing the litigants in this case, the bankruptcy code envisions that creditors will come forward.
Well, what do you think the answer to my question is? Is there any way a bankruptcy court can undo a discharge that was granted under a mistaken apprehension of the facts?
I don't think there should be done that in that case, Your Honor, where the litigants didn't come forward and challenge the discharge in the first place. They have a duty to do so. They have an obligation under the code to come forward and challenge
the... So where a debtor has concealed, destroyed, mutilated, falsified, or failed to keep or preserve records, etc., as 727 says, and the bankruptcy court didn't know that at the time the discharge was granted, that's tough luck. You just have to give these people who are pretty much engaging in fraud, a discharge?
First of all, I don't think, Your Honor, that there's any fraud engaged with regard to the bankruptcy court. This woman came in, she answered every question put to her at the meeting of creditors.
Invoking the Fifth, of course.
Not usually. She did invoke the Fifth. I don't think it was usually. You've seen only excerpts of that. She took the Fifth Amendment at time, which is a constitutionally given right. I mean, if you're going to say that she's going to be impeached in her credibility, impeached in her ability to use the bankruptcy court process because she invoked a constitutionally given right, I think you're taking something away from her that was meant to be given to her. She has a right to say, I'm not going to give evidence that could put
I don't disagree with that, but there is also a provision that bankruptcy is a privilege in a sense, and if the debtor has failed to keep the records that would be necessary in order to determine what the debts are, then 727 addresses that. How many other creditors were there, by the way, other than Mr. Dish? Were there a very large number of other creditors?
There were a significant amount of creditors.
Okay.
Mr. Dish was obviously, to be honest, I think there's about $1 million worth of debt. The judgment entered in this case on behalf of Mr. Dish was obviously in the neighborhood of $650,000 or so. So this was the bulk of the debt here. There were other creditors I can guesstimate right now, and it would be in the evidence, but there's about 20 more creditors or so. But again, those creditors would only accumulate about $300,000 worth of debt.
Did they get paid 100 cents on the dollar?
Nobody got paid. There is money in the bankruptcy court now, which is going to be distributed from the assets of Ms. Rasmussen.
Okay.
The reasons given for the revocation by the bankruptcy court are purely equitable in nature. The bankruptcy court utilized Section 105 of the bankruptcy code to reach the equitable result that it wanted. And again, I call this court's attention to its Greenig decision. I don't think you can reconcile what this bankruptcy court did with this court's decision in Greenig. I think they are completely opposite in terms of their effect. And I think in this case, you've got to look back to the Greenig decision that you utilized, that you wrote, to say that this cannot be done. Without an adversary action being filed dealing with revocation, Faye Rasmussen had no ability to move for dismissal because of the failure to meet the statutory requirements for revocation. Without an adversary action being filed, Faye Rasmussen had no ability to defend herself in a trial setting on the revocation issue. The plaintiff never pled the remedy of revocation, never moved for the remedy,
and never mentioned the word revocation whatsoever during the time of the trial.
The other side says that there was never an objection to amending the pleadings to conform to the proof.
Your Honor, if you look at the beginning of the case, there was, at the time of evidence being introduced, there was an objection being made on the part of Rasmussen to the introduction of documentary evidence. There was a motion to strike that documentary evidence.
What happened at the end when there was a formal motion to amend the pleadings to conform to the proof?
At the end? What was the question again, sir?
At the end of the proceeding,
right.
There was a formal motion to amend the pleadings to include a 727 claim to conform to the proof that was presented.
Right.
What happened?
There was nothing done at the time of the trial. Only during the time of the decision did the court inform us that the motion had been granted.
Isn't that a pretty good indication that there was really no surprise about the 727 claims being present in the case?
I think that's a clear indication. When I made the the motion was made after I had made my closing argument. It was made after I noted in my closing argument that I believed that there had been no motion made dealing with 727. It was done because I asserted that the case was only under 523 of the Bankruptcy Code. So only after all of that was done was a motion made to make it clear, to make Mr. Dish's position known that he thought it was a 727 case. So I think there's no doubt that there was surprise in this case, Your Honor. There was an objection made prior to the case starting at trial. There was an objection made during the time of trial to the introduction at the onset of any evidence dealing with Section 727. The court ruled at that time that 727 issues are always before the court when there's a failure to explain the loss of assets. And he ruled, Judge Martin ruled, that it does not have to be pled.
What kinds of things would you have introduced in the proceeding if it had come in any different way, any more proper way in your view?
Certainly the focus of the case would have changed, Your Honor. If indeed we had to try and prove specifically where every dollar went, we would have spent time and energy trying to do that. But when we were not forced to have to do that, when we were able to prevail under Section 523 with the evidence that we produced, there was no need to go any further. We would have tried to deal with some of these issues and tried to deal with the loss of assets if we had had time and noticed that we were dealing with a 727 case. The bankruptcy court's... I think I also want to call the court's attention to the severe prejudice suffered under Section 727. If you're allowed to introduce this evidence, the prejudice is that she already had her discharge in hand. The prejudice would be that every pleading in this case concerns Section 523 of the Bankruptcy Code. And I want to call the court's particular attention to the pretrial statement that's required to be produced by the bankruptcy court. It requires litigants to come to tell the judge what the issues are, what the facts are. If you look at that document, only Section 523 issues are in there. And the court, the bankruptcy court, then issues an order stating that the only issues that will be tried will be those introduced in the pretrial statement. That was not followed in this case. Obviously, if the court orders that the 523 issues are going to be the focus of the trial, why should we then, as the defendant, be worried about Section 727 issues? Every document you have before you says 523. Nothing ever appeared in this case in the documents introduced prior to the time of the trial that said anything about Section 727. There's some of the severe prejudice and the undue hardship suffered by the debtor in responding to these arguments. And I also call the court's attention to the McClellan versus Cantrell case issued by this court dealing with Section 523. That says whenever you've got an allegation of fraud under Section 523, every sort of artifice used by the debtor can be brought in to prove up the fraud issues. That's why we were not concerned about the breadth of the Section 523 language found in the complaint or during the depositions. Everything pointed towards the McClellan versus Cantrell focus on Section 523. We weren't worried about the breadth because the breadth we thought were going to the fraud allegations under 523. There's going to be an overlap of those things, but it does not necessarily mean that they're focusing on 727. There was no need to focus on 727 when the discharge had already been granted by the court and nobody objected to discharge.
hear now from Mr. Giesen.
Okay, please, the court, counsel. The bankruptcy code is intended and was designed to discharge only an honest debtor from that person's debts. The evidence clearly established, and both Judge Martin and Judge Crabb found that the debtor in this case was not forthcoming, was not honest, and in Judge Crabb's words, engaged in possibly criminal conduct.
But Mr. Giesen, here are some of my problems with your position. First of all, a fair amount of the record-keeping problems come to light at the 341 meeting, which is long before the time for filing these kinds of complaints existed. So I'm not sure that Mr. Dish was sandbagged into thinking that there wasn't a potential 727 issue here. So that's the first thing. And the second thing is, you know, as Mr. Kepler has argued, this court has said 105 isn't there to just sort of fill in the blanks whenever the rest of the rules are inconvenient. 105 has a much more confined scope. So there's that problem as well. And thirdly, as Mr. Kepler was just saying, there is a pretty substantial overlap between the 523 kind of fraud issue and the 727. So I'm not sure what kind of notice one gets that 727 is in play from what went on here. I think what Judge Martin said was really quite overbroad. 727 isn't, quote, always there in every 523 case.
I would agree it's not always present, but on the facts of this case, Ms. Rasmussen's claims of surprise are not borne out by the record. She was clearly on notice one of the central issues in this case would be where the money went. The complaint originally filed requested an accounting. The joint pretrial statement Mr. Kepler referred to defined one of the issues as the use, application, and whereabouts or diversion of funds. And that was in July before we'd even had discovery and passed the original 60-day deadline. The defendant in that joint pretrial statement affirmatively asserted that she never converted monies into cash for her personal use, and the money went into the business for payroll, overhead, food, groceries, and the like. So early on, she asserted that she would establish where these monies went to Mr. Dish's detriment at that point.
But why didn't you ever file a 727 complaint?
She asserted...
Or a complaint to revoke the discharge.
Right. In hindsight, that would have been a...
Well, of course. Hindsight being what it is. But
because in her trial brief, even, she said that she would testify that the money went for business purposes. She paid the grocer, the staff, the landlord, and she did so testify at trial. Her proof fell far short of establishing what she hoped it would, and there were glaring gaps in it. With respect to the element of surprise, and as you noted, the elements of proof often overlap, there was no surprise, there was no prejudice. Ms. Rasmussen, from the onset of this case, was aware that this would be an issue. The discovery requests of her asked her with respect to every check Mr. Dish had given her to name the person, the recipient, provide copies of all documentation and receipts showing the disposition of those funds. And she claimed that she was surprised and unable to address this. Until today, we still have not received any offer of proof as to any additional evidence that she could have presented or any way in which she was prejudiced in the legal sense, in that her ability to properly defend and confront the allegations was hampered. She simply has no such evidence.
So your position has to be that... That the response to my question, what would you have done differently or what evidence would have been different if you had been told before this amendment of the pleadings to conform to the proof at the end that 727 was in play, is basically nothing, that she already knew what the pertinent issues were. I just want to understand, you know, that's your response?
No. Had she been more forthcoming...
No, had you been more forthcoming, had you put 727 into the case up front the way it ought to have been done, what would she have said or what evidence could she have put in that was different from what she actually was putting in?
We submit that there is none.
All right.
And Judge Martin specifically asked that of her counsel at the trial. And he said the proofs are essentially the same.
Well, what about this 9024 issue, which the district court, as I recall, didn't reach because she thought the 105 point was all right? I mean, is that a better vehicle? Is that a possible vehicle for justifying what the bankruptcy judge did?
We think that's a perfectly appropriate vehicle, and it was designed and intended to grant relief from judgment where there has been mistake, and it was a ministerial act, the granting of the bankruptcy, or where there's been misrepresentation or misconduct on the part of a debtor. And certainly, Ms. Rasmussen engaged in substantial misconduct. And there's also subsection 6 of that rule that provides for any other reason justifying relief. Rule 60, incorporated in section 9024, is designed specifically for this type of factual situation in order to afford relief from a judgment that was granted either ministerially or by mistake or without full knowledge of the facts of surrounding the case. We also believe that Ms. Rasmussen implicitly consented to the amendment and specifically waived any objection. The motion was made at the close of the trial before any adjudication to amend the pleadings in the context of 727 to conform to the evidence. Rasmussen interposed no objection whatsoever at that point.
Right, but let me just go back for a minute to this other issue. You know, as I said before, at the 341 meeting even, she's invoking the Fifth Amendment all the time. She's not producing records. She's not telling anybody about what happened to these assets. And there's another aspect to the whole bankruptcy process, which is, of course, fairness to all of the creditors. Now, to the extent one might have thought that Mr. Dish wasn't going to be pursuing a 727 claim, everybody else relies on the process as it was going forward. And if there are some substantial number of other creditors, how should we what happens if we let the result below stand? Does it hurt them?
No, it actually benefits them because it revokes what was, in hindsight, an improvidently, inappropriately granted discharge. And I'd also point out the other principal creditor also filed an adversary proceeding and relied on Section 523 because that was the information that was available at that time.
And what was the result of that?
Well,
adversary proceeding.
That went to trial, and as I understand, that bank did not prevail on the grounds of lack of justifiable reliance, I believe. But certainly Rasmussen's two principal creditors, Mr. Dish had an adversary claim for $907,000, and the Monona State Bank had a claim for $150,000. So there may have been some other smaller creditors, but those were the two largest and constituted nearly all of her debt. So those adversary proceedings were pending, and she was on notice with respect to those. We also believe that this court's decision in Kontrick, later affirmed by the Supreme Court, should control. The law is indisputable at this point that Section 4004 is not jurisdictional. The debtor can, therefore, forfeit or waive any objection to timeliness of the amendment of the complaint. And in this case, that's precisely what the debtor did. She never asserted any timeliness objection at any point in the proceedings.
But it looked like Mr. Kepler was saying, you know, hey, wait a minute, I thought this was a 523. Maybe he doesn't say the word timeliness, but he spoke up pretty promptly when 727, that's when the judge says, oh, 727 is always there.
Well, he did object on grounds of relevance because of the scope of the pleadings. But at that point,
isn't that the same way as saying 727 hasn't been brought into the case yet?
It's different from a timeliness objection, as I read Kontrick, as I understand it. A relevance objection is somewhat different from a request to amend followed by an objection to that request because of lack of timeliness. And there was ample opportunity in closing argument. 727 was argued at length on behalf of the creditor, Mr. Dish, and there was no response that that issue had been raised untimely. There was an explicit motion pursuant to Rule 15 to amend at the close of the case, and to adopt the position urged by the debtor in this situation would eviscerate or nullify, basically, Rule 15 as well as Rule 60. The goals that should be fostered by the exercise of equitable discretion, as the lower courts did in this case, are those, as this court has pointed out, that are consistent with the underlying policies of the bankruptcy code. And again, that goes back to an improvident granting of relief to a person who's been dishonest with her creditors. It's also our view that Rule 15B has a mandatory aspect to it. It provides that the court shall amend the pleadings to conform to the evidence, and that when the issues are tried by implicit consent. We believe there was implicit consent to the trial of these issues, notwithstanding the evidentiary objections, because Rasmussen herself put forth a great deal of evidence that would go only to 727 issues and not necessarily to the embezzlement.
But, for example, what?
Well, she testified regarding her extensive bookkeeping experience. She testified she never filed income tax returns. That would certainly have no bearing on a defense of a 523 claim. She testified that she dealt in cash to avoid paying the Wisconsin Department of Revenue.
I thought that was an interesting argument. I'm defrauding the Wisconsin Department of Revenue, so I should be excused.
She also put in substantial substantive evidence, cashier's checks, bank accounts, bank statements, check stubs, partially explaining or showing the use or loss of the funds and assets. Those, as the lower court determined, fell woefully short of explaining or satisfactorily explaining the whereabouts of those assets. So she did put in a great deal of evidence and therefore implicitly consented to a trial of those issues.
Well, if it wasn't relevant to 523, I think that's the key question.
Correct. And again, there's always some overlap, or there not always is, but certainly may be overlap between 523 and 727, but I believe the examples I cited would not go to a 523 defense.
You know, all this 527 stuff gets a little boring after a while. Why did he give her all this money?
That's a question that probably will never be answered. He had known her for 40 years. She came from a very good family and trusted and believed in her, essentially. She was also very convincing and a successful con artist. He's not the only one who gave her tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars.
He gave her 85% of the money here to run this cafe, didn't he?
Correct. At his entire retirement, basically.
Sometimes love is involved.
I don't think that was involved, but certainly guile and cunning and gullibility. The bankruptcy court does have discretionary equitable powers, not to avoid the provisions of the code, but to implement them. Judge Martin pointed out in his decision he was reluctant to do that, but he felt compelled to do so to give effect to the primary purposes and underlying policies of the Bankruptcy Act. We believe that was an appropriate exercise of discretion under the circumstances and facts of this case, and would urge this court to affirm the decision of the lower courts. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giesen. You have 1 minute, Mr. Kepler.
I will speak fast, Your Honor.
Section Rule 9024 was talked about. That says that bankruptcy rule 60 applies except when a complaint to revoke a discharge in a liquidation case may be filed only within the time limit given by 727E of the Bankruptcy Code. There was no complaint filed in this case dealing with revocation of discharge. The evidence, Mr. Giesen just admitted that much of the evidence under Section 523 overlapped under 727 issues.
Did any of it not overlap, though? I mean, that's the key question.
I don't think any of it. I think all of it overlaps, Your Honor. It all deals with fraud. It all deals with artifice. It all deals with embezzlement, possibly. And those are the issues he raised under the Section 523 complaint. We thought we were only dealing with the 523 complaint because of the allegations in the complaint, because of the allegations found in all of the documentation that was filed with the court. The pretrial statement, the complaint, the adversary cover sheet says 523. The court's orders say it's going to be tried under 523. The focus in
what difference in the final analysis does this make to Ms. Rasmussen? I mean, if this is really a Chapter 7, she's not going to see any of this money, whether it goes to Mr. Dish or whether the bankruptcy discharge is revoked or whether it's not revoked.
Certainly does make a great difference. If the discharge is taken away, which it was in this case, she will never escape the $1 million worth of debt that she has. If indeed the discharge is given effect, then all of the debt except all the debt including Mr. Dish's discharge, debt is discharged because she prevailed at the trial on Section 523. The court found that all of the allegations under Section 523 were sustained in her favor. She did not lose under Section 523. His debt should be discharged and all of the other debt would be discharged. She still has the Monona State Bank issue to deal with because that was not found to be discharged, contrary to what Mr. Giesen just represented. She will have an obligation of approximately $110,000 still to deal with after bankruptcy because I believe that the court in that case found it to be moot because they took away the discharge. He had held it open. So that would still be something she will have to deal with. But in this case, it makes a great deal of difference because the discharge should wipe out all of the debt that was there. Thank you very much.
The court would like to thank both Mr. Kepler and Mr. Giesen for their fine presentations, and the case will be taken under advisement.